multiple missile launches. It's even asked China and Russia to pressure North Korea to stop. I mean, really? Do you think that the U.S. even... Well, I mean, hey, you got to give it to the U.S. You know, they're asking what they cite as a number one and two national security threats to please do us a favor and stop North Korea from launching these missiles. How do you view that U.S. request from both China and Russia? In under a minute, please.
Well, why would they help the United States in any sense in this issue, when Russia, of course, is under attack by the United States, and where China has been a target of hostility from the U.S., in which the Taiwan issue is now being played with. It's not a situation in which you have a whole lot of trust between these countries.
Okay.
In other circumstances, perhaps there would be cooperation if
you're
working towards like a security architecture in the Asia Pacific. They would work together. But to the extent that the U.S. has named Russia an enemy and also China as an enemy, you're not going to get too many favors out of them.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitahui and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 2 to 4 of Surah Nahl, recited by Murtaza Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yunazzilul malaa'ikata birruhi min amrihi 'ala man yasha'u min 'ibadihi an أنذروا أنه لا إله إلا أنا فاتقون. خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من نطفة فإذا هو خصيم مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. He sends down the angels with inspiration by His commandment on whom He pleases of His servants, saying, "Give the warning that there is no God but Me. Therefore, be careful of your duty to Me." He created the heavens and the earth with the truth. Highly exalted be He above what they associate with Him. He created man from a small seed, and lo, he is an open contender.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Iran backs China's initiative for settling the Ukraine crisis, saying that it is time for genuine diplomacy to be activated to end the conflict. The senior Russian official warns that the continued flow of Western weapons to Ukraine could spell a global nuclear catastrophe. And another Palestinian man dies after being shot in the abdomen by Israeli settlers during an attack south of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it supports China's plan to end the war in Ukraine, calling for genuine diplomacy to resolve the conflict. Iran's foreign ministry says the proposal put forth by Beijing can pave the way for a mutually agreed framework to settle the conflict. It also denounced the West's unilateral measures, saying that it is time to put an end to actions that only fuel the flames of war. The ministry also rejected what it called the Cold War era's hegemonic mentality, and blamed the U.S.-led NATO for being behind many global crises, including the Ukraine war. Tehran has also expressed its readiness to contribute to a peaceful settlement of the conflict. On Friday, China called for a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine in a 12-point position paper that it released on the political settlement of the crisis. Russia's former President Dmitry Medvedev warns that the continued flow of weapons to Ukraine could spell a global nuclear catastrophe. Medvedev, who is the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, said supplying Kiev with more arms would diminish the prospect of resolving the Ukraine conflict through dialogue. He said that Moscow's enemies dismissed the fact that the goals would definitely result in what he called an apocalypse. Last week, the Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a similar warning about the threats of a nuclear disaster. Putin compared the ongoing war with Ukraine to an existential battle for the survival of Russia. Moscow has repeatedly sounded the alarm that the Western military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war with Ukraine. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has sacked the top military commander who was tasked with overseeing the war with Russia in the eastern Donbas region. Zelensky announced Edward Moskaloff's firing in a one-line decree without giving any explanation for the move. Moskaloff took over as commander of the Joint Forces of Ukraine shortly after Russia launched its special military operation against the country in February of last year. His removal comes as Russian troops are trying to capture Donetsk and Luhansk provinces, known together as the Donbas. Few regions in Ukraine have seen as much destruction as Donbas.
A migrant shipwreck in waters south of Italy has killed 58, including several children. This is the latest in a series of migrant tragedies in Europe that have claimed thousands of lives. Stay with us for a deeper look at the incident in our news review program.
Time now for the news review. The death toll from a migrant shipwreck near the coast of southern Italy has risen to 58. Several children are also among the victims. Italian Coast Guard saying around 80 migrants have survived the tragic incident. The vessel crashed against rocks during rough sea weather. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says that she is deeply saddened by the tragedy. She called for progress and installed reform of EU asylum rules. Italy is one of the main landing points for migrants trying to enter Europe by sea. More than 20,000 people have reportedly died or gone missing in the central Mediterranean since 2014. Let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have Max Civili, our correspondent in Rome. John Stepling, author and commentator, is also joining me from Indre, Norway. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Max, beginning with you, you said that rights activists in your reports and also other correspondents' reports, they're mostly blaming Prime Minister Meloni for this, but she doesn't seem to be blaming herself for this, does she?
Well, since day one of her mandate, Giorgia Meloni has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what she calls irregular migration. Basically, the Meloni government has been accusing, since day one, charity ships of acting as a pull factor and encouraging people traffickers. And in order, the government said that to counter this trend, the Meloni government introduced a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships operating in the Mediterranean Sea and rescuing asylum seekers. This happened in November last year. Basically, these new measures force all NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately, without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. And this, of course, prevents NGO ships from saving other migrants. This is what at least an Italian court said, and what the Council of Europe said a few weeks ago. The Council of Europe has urged Italy to scrap that decree, that provision, describing it as a breach of international law. This is why some humanitarian groups blame Prime Minister Meloni.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, John, it's not only Italy, it's other European countries as well. But in terms of Ursula von der Leyen saying that she's deeply saddened by this tragedy, I mean, is this really true? Is this not duplicity? Because maybe it's blue-eyed human rights, huh? Because when the Ukrainians, spread out in Europe, they were embraced warmly. But when people from other countries, find their way, they take to rough seas and they endanger their lives, this is the response that they're getting.
Right. Well, look, if we step back just a little bit, this is the history of capitalism. The Western world has exploited the non-Western world for 150 years through colonialism, colonial settlers, occupation. And it was racialized, racial tiers were created to justify the slave trade. And this has not changed. And the U.S. is the great imperial power. These people are fleeing intolerable conditions, war zones. And as you say, Ukrainians are relatively welcomed when they enter Europe from a war zone. But black Africans or Muslims or South Asians or Latin Americans are not welcome in the Western world. Biden just passed a law that will stop all migration across the southern border of the U.S. No asylum applications will be accepted. It's a law that is actually worse than the one Trump put in place. So, but this is not a new story. I mean, this is, as I say, gone on for 150 years. The U.S. has business interests in Africa. It has military bases in all but one country in Africa. Those bases and soldiers are there to protect Western business interests, whether it's mining or whatever it is. And this has been a story that has gone on with genocidal, you know, implications at times, whether it's Tanzania, Australia, parts of Africa, German South Africa, Latin America, Central America, all the way back to the United Fruit Company in Central America. I mean, this is nothing new.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and contribution. Max Civelli in Italy, John Stepeling in Norway. Israeli settlers have killed a Palestinian man near the West Bank city of Nablus amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. Sameh Akhtash, 37, was killed after he was shot with a live bullet during an assault by Israeli settlers and forces south of Nablus. Around 400 Palestinians were also injured after troops and settlers raided parts of the city. They blocked the streets, pelted stones, and set fire to several Palestinian homes and vehicles. The raid followed the killing of two Israelis in the West Bank settlement earlier in the day. The regime has intensified its deadly crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories since the formation of a far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. 66 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank this year so far. And staying with news from the occupied territories, the Palestinian Authority and Israeli officials have held talks in Jordan amid heightened tensions in the occupied territories. The talks in the Red Sea port of Aqaba also included officials from the U.S. as well as Egypt. At the end of the meeting, the Israeli and Palestinian Authority officials stressed the need for de-escalation on the ground. They also agreed to meet again in Egypt next month. Resistance groups, including Hamas, had called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the meeting. They say that it is a U.S. plot against Palestinian aspirations.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba security summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's president says the Iraqi territory should not be used to hatch plots or to pose threats to its neighboring countries. Ebrahim Raisi told the visiting Iraqi defense minister, Thabit Mohammed Said al-Abbas, that Iran regards Iraq's security as its own and supports efforts to strengthen stability and security in that country. The Iranian president further highlighted Tehran's backing for Baghdad's attempts to rebuild Iraq on both economic and military fronts. Raisi described Iran-Iraq borders as those of friendship and cooperation. The top Iraqi official in turn appreciated Iran's unwavering support for the Iraqi nation during the invasion of the country by alien forces and foreign-sponsored Daesh terrorists. He said that Baghdad will not allow opportunist elements to threaten borders and territories of the two countries. Earlier, the Iraqi defense chief also held talks with his Iranian counterpart.
Iran's defense minister salutes during an official ceremony to welcome his Iraqi counterpart. Thabit Mohammed Said al-Abbasi visited Tehran as Iran and Iraq are eyeing regional security and stability through stronger defense cooperation, with both sides emphasizing border security.
We fully support a united and stable Iraq. We will help Iraq achieve stability and security. That will lead to the development of the country, and we are prepared to help Iraq in this regard. Based on our historical and geopolitical ties, we consider Iraq's security our own security.
The Iranian defense minister also emphasized that the Islamic Republic will not allow its borders to be threatened. He described the presence of extra-regional forces and the Zionist regime in particular as the main threats, not just to Iraq itself, but also to regional security. Meanwhile, the Iraqi defense minister voiced Baghdad's readiness in strengthening ties with Tehran.
The main objective of this visit is to boost bilateral relations between Iran and Iraq. On top of the agenda is the war that Iraq is fighting against terrorism. Both Iran and Iraq are facing national security challenges. Stronger defense relations can alleviate the situation, and in our meeting, we discussed this issue.
Tehran has had good and high-level relations with neighboring countries, particularly Iraq, in the past years, reiterating that international ties and the improvement of ties with neighbors are among the most important arenas of Iran's foreign policy. Iran has made great achievements with regards to its defense capabilities and has reached a level where it is now self-sufficient. The defense minister reiterated that the Islamic Republic is prepared to share its valuable experiences with the Iraqi side. Gisum Shahmani, Tehran.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression. Even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
in the limelight.
The war in Ukraine has created huge political, economic and security losses for Europe, and the energy crisis caused by the Russian oil and gas embargo can be considered the most immediate and main impact of the war in Ukraine on Europe's economy. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Britain's Financial Times newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Economists warn the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the Eurozone this year. According to the latest report, prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, while the unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1% by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the Eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. The energy crisis in the European Union worsened over the summer when sanctions and technical setbacks led to the first interruptions in gas supplies from Russia. While most economists have said that Europe is past the worst of the energy crisis this year, many worry that the prospect of energy rationing would return next heating season, especially if the upcoming months are cold and cause increased tapping of gas reserves. Economists are also worried about the outcome of further steps to stem inflation by the European Central Bank, the ECB. Marcello Missori, an economics professor at Lewis University in Rome, Italy, warned that further interest rate hikes could lead to a severe recession in the euro area. Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story and tells us more. Official figures showed recently inflation in Sweden surged to its highest point in the past 3 decades in December, fueled by soaring electricity prices that have hit the cost of living. Statistics Sweden said the consumer price index, the CPI, accelerated to 12.3%, up from 11.5% in November, the highest figure since February of 1991. The main driver was the price of electricity, which rose 28.8% in December compared to the month before and 45.3% compared to a year earlier. Sweden's inflation rate adjusted for fixed interest rates, the figure used by Sweden's central bank to guide monetary policy, jumped to 10.2% on an annual basis, up from 9.5% in November. In a bid to counter soaring inflation, the Scandinavian country's central bank has sharply hiked its key interest rate in recent months, from 0 in April to 2.5% currently, with its next monetary policy meeting scheduled for early February. The bank has signalled that more increases are underway. Inflation has soared worldwide in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which started in February of 2022, prompting central banks to hike interest rates. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to official data released recently, Hungary's annual inflation rate spiked to 24.5% in December, the highest level since March of 1996. The Hungarian Central Statistical Office said electricity, gas and other fuels, along with food prices, were the main drivers of high inflation in Hungary. Electricity, gas and other fuels were 55.5% more expensive in December. Food prices jumped 44.8% on an annual basis. Consumer durables jumped 13.6%. And service charges were up 9.5%. The authority said consumer prices increased by 1.9% on average in 1 month and by 14.5% on average in 2022, compared to the previous year. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story. Portugal's National Institute of Statistics announced the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, registered an average annual variation of 7.8% in 2022 in the country, the highest since 1992. Last year, the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, rose 6.5 percentage points compared to 2021, when it was 1.3%. Rising energy and food prices were the main elements contributing to the increase in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Portuguese inflation rose more intensely in the first half of last year, while prices slowed down in the last 2 months of 2022. According to China's Xinhua news agency, Statistics Netherlands said on Tuesday, 10th of January, the annual inflation rate in the Netherlands was 10% in 2022, the highest since 1975, when the rate was 10.2% as a result of the oil crisis. Last year, the price development of energy, such as electricity, gas and district heating, in particular contributed to the high rate. The energy was on average 114% more expensive in 2022 than in 2021. The inflation rate was 2.7% in 2021. Food and motor fuels also had an impact on inflation. Food was 10.8% more expensive than 12 months previously. In 2021, food prices were still 0.2% lower. The rise in food prices was mainly caused by meat, dairy products, bread and grains and vegetables. In 2022, motor fuels were 18.1% more expensive than the year before, while in 2021, the increase was 16.8%. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said on Tuesday, 10th of January, Greece's economic growth is likely to show just 1.1% this year from a 5.1% clip in 2022, as soaring energy costs and continued uncertainty about the war in Ukraine hurt spending and investments. Since the lifting of COVID restrictions, the Greek economy has recovered strongly thanks to the robust tourism revenues and improving consumer spending and investments. However, surging energy costs, supply disruptions and uncertainty, mainly because of the war in Ukraine, are sharply slowing down the recovery in Greece. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said the war is directly affecting Greece's energy supply and costs. Its indirectly effects are compressing spending and delaying investment and hiring. Inflation, driven by rising energy prices, hit a 30-year high of 12% last summer in Greece and is eating away at Greek households' income. Britain's Guardian newspaper has also covered the same story. The Italian government statistics office reported recently prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, with surging energy prices contributing the most to what was the largest full-year increase since the mid-1980s. The full-year rate was the highest recorded in Italy since a 9.2% annual increase in 1985, when Italy still used the lira currency. In December, prices were 11.6% higher than in the same month in 2021, and down from 11.8% in November. It was still the third highest one-month rate recorded since the introduction of the euro currency in 1999. According to the National Institute of Statistics, the seven highest monthly inflation rates recorded in Italy since 1999 have all been in the last 7 months. High energy prices have been responsible for the bulk of these increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges caused by the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community, and most importantly, the people. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's economy and the Kashmir situation. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE Free Trade Pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out which seem to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations, which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, they're done. It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French, and for that matter, Israel and the Economic Union, which have had over 500 years of dominance to get things right, and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that, and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change, and the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, they're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector works that way. The way corporatism works basically is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at the lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FDA's, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of 4 civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. 2 more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian pandits, Kashmiri pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residents. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu Pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense, that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir But the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination. And this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council. Now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri.